companions have surely accomplished something with their talk. But what? The episode at the Machusa's home exemplifies a venerable practice with which Western Apache speakers exploit the evocative power of place names to comment on the moral conduct of persons who are absent from the scene, called speaking with names, Yalte Be'iji. This verbal routine also allows those who engage in it to register claims about their own moral worth, about aspects of their social relationships with other people on hand, and about a particular way of attending to the local landscape that is avowed to produce a beneficial form of heightened self-awareness. And, as if this were not enough, much of what gets said and done is attributed to unseen Apache ancestors who are prompted by the voices of conversational participants to communicate in a collective voice that no one actually hears. All in all, the practice of speaking with names is a subtle and subterranean affair. To gain an understanding of this practice and the sources of its coherence for Western Apache people, I shall assume that spoken discourse is a cooperative activity in which individuals seek to accomplish a range of communicative purposes. I shall also assume that participants in many kinds of discourse use language to explore with each other the significance of past and potential events, drawing from these examinations certain consequences for their present and future actions. Finally, I shall assume that speakers pursue such objectives by producing utterances that are intended to perform several speech acts simultaneously, and that hearers, making dexterous use of relevant bodies of cultural knowledge, react and respond to these acts at different levels of abstraction. Spoken discourse, then, is more than a chain of situated utterances. Rather, as William Labov and David Fanshawe have shown, discourse consists in a developing matrix of utterances and actions, bound together by a web of shared understandings pertinent to both, which serves as an expanding context for interpreting the meanings of utterances and actions alike. More a matter of linguistic function than of linguistic form, coherence in discourse is achieved when participants put their utterances to interlocking forms of mutually recognizable work. More a matter of implicit doings than of explicit sayings, coherence is what participants hear, though generally they fail to notice hearing it, when their work is going well. In Lola Machusa's somnolent yard, where the work of discourse went off without a hitch, coherence was never in question. Neither was the smooth implementation of a Western Apache technique for appropriating the natural landscape, a distinctive cultural framework for interpreting the landscape and turning it by means of speech to specific social ends. Never in question, that is, to anyone but myself. A superfluous, slightly stupefied, and roundly perplexed outsider. What did Lola Machuse and those other Apaches imagine themselves to be up to as they sat around swapping place names? How were they making sense, and what sort of sense were they making? What manner of thinking informed their utterances and the actions their utterances performed? What, in short, was the culture of their discourse? We gave that woman pictures. If the discourse at Lola Machusa's home is to be usefully understood, steps must be taken to enter the conceptual world of the people who produced it. Needless to say, we cannot recover their experience of their discourse as it actually occurred. What Maurice Merleau-Ponty called the inner experience of language spoken now. But we can explore retrospectively, and therefore in reconstructive terms, what participants in the encounter took their discourse to be about, why they saw fit to contribute to it as they did, and how they interpreted the utterances and actions that composed it. In addition, we can explore the culturally based assumptions and beliefs that made these interpretations possible, the linguistic ideology with which persons from Cibicue rationalize for themselves and explain to others what spoken words are capable of doing when used in certain ways. In short, we can construct an ethnographic account of the speech event itself, an interpretation of Apache interpretations that relates the event to the body of thought that made its occurrence meaningful and to the particular social circumstances that made its meaning unique. All such undertakings profit from the guidance of experienced native instructors, and no one living at Cibicue is more capable or willing in this regard than Lola Machuse herself. So let us begin, as in fact I did shortly after the episode at her camp took place, by considering her account of what transpired as the women drank their Pepsi and Clifford snapped at flies. We gave that woman, Louise, pictures to work on in her mind. We didn't speak too much to her. We didn't hold her down. That way she could travel in her mind. She could add on to them, the pictures, easily. We gave her clear pictures with place names, so her mind went to those places, standing in front of them as our ancestors did long ago. That way she could see what happened there long ago. She could hear stories in her mind, perhaps hear our ancestors speaking. She could recall the knowledge of our ancestors. We call it speaking with names. Place names are all we need for that, speaking with names. We just fix them up. That woman was too sad. She was worried too much about her younger brother, so we tried to make her feel better. We tried to make her think good thoughts. That woman's younger brother acted stupidly. He was stupid and careless. He failed to show respect. No good. We said nothing critical about him to her. We talked around it. Those place names are strong. After a while, I gave her a funny story. She didn't get mad. She was feeling better. She laughed. Then she had enough, I guess. She spoke to the dog about her younger brother, criticizing him, so we knew we had helped her out. Lola Machuse recorded this statement 2 days after the speech event at her home took place, and 4 days later, having discussed her account with all parties involved, I determined to treat it as a guide for subsequent inquiries. Everyone to whom I presented Lola's account agreed that it was encompassing and astute. It touched, they said, on everything that was essential for getting a proper sense of what speaking with names might be used to accomplish. But they also agreed that it was rather too highly condensed, a bare-bones sort of interpretation, adequate for persons familiar with the practice, but understandably opaque to a neophyte such as myself, and that it could profit from explication and fleshing out. Never one to be outdone, Lola Machuse agreed instantly with the agreeers, saying she was well aware of the problem, thank you very much, and had understood all along that further instruction would be necessary. Sometimes talk is complicated, she observed, and one must move slowly to get to the bottom of it. So with all of us scrambling to agree with Lola, and with Lola herself firmly in charge, the fleshing out process began. Our work took longer than I had expected, but now, with much of it done, Lola Machuse's original account seems better to me than ever. It provides, as one of my older Apache consultants told me it would, a straight path to knowing. And so I have used Lola's interpretation here, partitioned into convenient segments, as a model, a path of a different kind for organizing and presenting my own. We gave that woman pictures to work on in her mind. We didn't speak too much to her. We didn't hold her down. That way she could travel in her mind. She could add on to them easily. Western Apache conceptions of language and thought are cast in pervasively visual terms. Every occasion of speaking Yalty, provides tangible evidence of thinking, natsikes, and thinking occurs in the form of pictures, be'elzahi, that persons see, yoi, in their minds. Prompted by a desire to display thinking, niri, natsikes, speaking involves the use of language to depict, e'ele, and convey, yo'ale, these images to the members of an audience, such that they, on hearing, yiditzag, and holding, yoti, the speaker's words, can view, yineli, the images in their own minds. Thinking, as Apaches conceive of it, consists in picturing to oneself and attending privately to the pictures. Speaking consists in depicting one's pictures for other people, who are thus invited to picture these depictions and respond to them with depictions of their own. Discourse or conversation, uche yadachute, consists in a running exchange of depicted pictures and pictured depictions, a reciprocal representation and visualization of the ongoing thoughts of the participating speakers. But things are not really so neat and tidy. According to consultants from Sipikiu, the depictions offered by Western Apache speakers are invariably incomplete. Even the most gifted and proficient speakers contrive to leave things out, and small children who have not yet learned to indulge in such contrivances leave out many things. Consequently, Apache hearers must always add on, in agoden na, to depictions made available to them in conversation, augmenting and supplementing these spoken images with images they fashion for themselves. This process is commonly likened to adding stones to a partially finished wall or laying bricks upon the foundation of a house, because it is understood to involve a piling up of new materials onto like materials already in place. It is also said to resemble the rounding up of livestock, the bringing together, dala aji chindiu, of cattle or horses from scattered locations to a central place where other animals have been previously gathered. These metaphors all point to the same general idea, which is that depictions provided by Apache speakers are treated by Apache hearers as bases on which to build, as projects to complete, as invitations to exercise the imagination. Western Apache regards spoken conversation as a form of voluntary cooperation, the chi odach idi, in which all participants are entitled to displays of respect, yunosi. Accordingly, whenever people speak in cordial and affable tones, considerations of kindness and politeness, biu gochoba, comes centrally into play. Such considerations may influence Apache speech in a multitude of ways, but none is more basic than the courtesy speakers display by refraining from speaking too much, la'ago yalti. Although the effects of this injunction are most clearly evident in the spare verbal style employed by Apache storytellers, people from Sibikiu insist that all forms of narration benefit from its application, and the reasons, they explain, are simple enough. A person who speaks too much, someone who describes too busily, who supplies too many details, who repeats and qualifies too many times, presumes without warrant on the right of hearers to build freely and creatively on the speaker's own depictions. With too many words, such a speaker acts to smother, bika yinulad, his or her audience by seeming to say arrogantly and coercively, I demand that you see everything that happened, how it happened and why it happened, exactly as I do. In other words, persons who speak too much insult the imaginative capabilities of other people, blocking their thinking, as one of my consultants said in English, and holding down their minds. So Western Apache narrators consistently take a different tack, implying by the economical manner of their speech, I will depict just enough for you to see what happened, how it happened, and perhaps why it happened. Add on to these depictions however you see fit. An effective narrator, people from Sibikyu report, never speaks too much. An effective narrator takes steps to open up thinking, thereby encouraging his or her listeners to travel in their minds. We gave her clear pictures with place names, so her mind went to those places, standing in front of them as our ancestors did long ago. That way she could see what happened there long ago. She could hear stories in her mind, perhaps hear our ancestors speaking. She could recall the knowledge of our ancestors. Nothing is more basic to the telling of a Western Apache story than identifying the geographical locations at which events in the story unfold. For unless Apache listeners are able to picture a physical setting for narrated events, unless, as one of my consultants said, your mind can travel to that place and really see it, the events themselves will be difficult to imagine. This is because events in the narrative will seem to happen nowhere, and such an idea, Apaches assert, is preposterous and disquieting. Placeless events are an impossibility. Everything that happens must happen somewhere. The location of an event is an integral aspect of the event itself, and identifying the event's location is therefore essential to properly depicting and effectively picturing the event's occurrence. For these reasons, placeless stories simply do not get told. Instead, all Apache narratives are verbally anchored to points upon the land with precise depictions of specific locations and what these depictions are accomplished with. What the primary spatial anchors of Apache narrative almost always turns out to be are place names. Some appreciation of the descriptive precision of Western Apache place names can be gained by matching names with photographs of their geographical reference. By way of illustration, consider these three names which have been segmented into their constituent morphemes and whose reference are discussed later. Ti'is bitu'a tu o'ine. Ti'is, cottonwood tree. Bitu'a, underneath it, beneath it. Tu, water. O, inward. Li, it flows. Ni, the one. Translation. Water flows inward under a cottonwood tree. Te, ligai, da, sidile. Te, rock, stone. Ligai, white, whiteness. Da, above ground level. Sidile, three or more form a compact cluster. E, the one. Translation. White rocks lie above in a compact cluster. Tse, bika, tu, yahine. Tse, rock, stone. Bika, on top of it, a flattish object. Tu, water. Ya, downward. He, linear succession of regularly repeated movements. Li, it flows. Ni, the one. Translation. Water flows down on a succession of flat rocks. Western Apache place names provide more than precise depictions of the sites to which the names refer. In addition, place names implicitly identify positions for viewing these locations, optimal vantage points, so to speak, from which the sites can be observed clearly and unmistakably, just as their names depict them. To picture a site from its name then requires that one imagine it as if standing or sitting at a particular spot, and it is to these privileged positions, Apaches say, that the images evoked by place names cause them to travel in their minds. Wherever the optimal vantage point for a named site may be located, east of the site or west, above it or below, near it or at some distance away, the vantage point is described as being in front of, Badnyu, the site, and it is there, centuries ago, that ancestors of the Western Apache are believed to have stood when they gave the site its name. Accordingly, consultants from CIBIQ explain that in positioning people's minds to look forward, bida, into space, a place name also positions their minds to look backward, ta'aji, into time. For as persons imagine themselves standing in front of a named site, they may imagine that they are standing in their ancestors' tracks, noizaye, bike'e, and from this psychological perspective, which is sometimes described as an intense form of daydreaming, biu onagoda. Traditional accounts of ancestral events associated with the site are said to be recalled with singular clarity and force. The capacity of Western Apache place names to situate people's minds in historical time and space is clearly apparent when names are used to anchor traditional narratives that depict ancestral life and illustrate aspects of ancestral knowledge. Noizaye bi kigoyai. But the evocative power of place names is most forcefully displayed when a name is used to substitute for the narrative it anchors, standing up alone, oa, as Apaches say, to symbolize the narrative as well as the knowledge it contains. On such occasions, a single place name may accomplish the communicative work of an entire saga or historical tale, and sometimes, depending on the immediate social circumstances, it may accomplish even more. For when place names are employed in this isolated and autonomous fashion, when, in other words, Apache people practice speaking with names, their actions are interpreted as a recommendation to recall ancestral stories and apply them directly to matters of pressing personal concern. And in emotionally charged contexts like these, my consultants maintain ancestral voices. Noizaye bizhi may seem to speak directly to the individuals involved. We call it speaking with names. Place names are all we need for that. Speaking with names. We just fix them up. The woman was too sad. She was worried too much about her younger brother, so we tried to make her feel better. We tried to make her think good thoughts. Speaking with names is considered appropriate under certain conditions only, and these conditions tend to occur infrequently. Consequently, as people from CIBIQ are quick to point out, place names are usually put to other communicative ends. Most of the time, place names are called upon to perform simple verbal chores, to indicate where one is going, for example, or to announce where one has been, to make plans for a forthcoming hunt, or to pinpoint the latest happenings gleaned from local gossip. When place names are used for ordinary purposes such as these, Apache speakers typically produce the names in shortened or contracted forms. Thus, the name, Ta'is Bitla Tu'oi, water flows inward under a cottonwood tree, is commonly heard as Ta'is Tla Oli or Ta'is Tu'oli. The name, Tse Bika Tu Yahili, water flows down on a succession of flat rocks, as Tse Ka Yahili or Tse Tu Yahili, and so forth. In marked contrast to these abbreviated renderings, place names intended to evoke mental pictures of the past are invariably spoken in full and are embellished or fixed up, nayidle, with an optional suffix that imparts an emphatic force roughly equivalent to English right here or at this very place. Accordingly, the place name Ta'is Bitla Tu'oli is pronounced in traditional narratives as Ta'is Bitla Tu'oline, the name Tse Bika Tu Yahili as Tse Bika Tu Yahiline, and so forth. Although the optional suffix may be employed for purposes other than helping to summon ancestral images and voices, my consultants agree that this is one of its primary functions, and at no time is that function as readily apparent as when Apache men and women, bent upon speaking with names, dispense with narratives completely and use place names in the expression X, Agodzayu. It happened at X, at this very place. This expression is normally reserved for social situations in which speaking of absent parties to persons closely connected to them must be accomplished with delicacy and tact. Specifically, the expression is used when ancestral knowledge seems applicable to difficulties arising from serious errors in someone else's judgment, but when voicing one's thoughts on the matter might be taken as evidence of arrogance, critical disapproval, or lack of sympathetic understanding. Instead, speaking with names enables those who engage in it to acknowledge a regrettable circumstance without explicitly judging it, to exhibit solicitude without openly proclaiming it, and to offer advice without appearing to do so. But speaking with names accomplishes more than this. A traditional Apache narrative, encapsulated in its own spatial anchor, the expression X, Agodzayu, is also a call to memory and imagination. Simultaneously, it is a call to persons burdened by worry and despair to take remedial action on behalf of themselves. Travel in your mind, the expression urges those to whom it is addressed. Travel in your mind to a point from which to view the place whose name has just been spoken. Imagine standing there as if in the tracks of your ancestors, and recall stories of events that occurred at that place long ago. Picture these events in your mind and appreciate, as if the ancestors were speaking to you directly, the knowledge the stories contain. Bring this knowledge to bear on your own disturbing situation. Allow the past to inform your understanding of the present. You will feel better if you do. And Western Apache people report that sometimes they do feel better. Having pictured distant places and dwelled on ancestral events, their worries become less acute, less sharp, tsu-ik-i, less hard, ntuliz, less noisy, gonch-ad, in their minds. Feelings of anxiety and emotional turbulence may give way to welcome sensations of smoothness, dilku, of softness, dedi'ile, of growing inner quiet, duwa gonch-ada. And when this actually happens, when ancestral knowledge works to give beneficial perspective and fresh recognition that trying times can be dealt with successfully and eventually overcome, persons thus heartened may announce that relationships characterized by pleasantness and goodness, goju, have been restored between themselves and their surroundings. A psychological balance has been reestablished, an optimistic outlook born of strengthened confidence and rejuvenated hope, and people may also announce that a sickness, nezgai, has been healed, nabilzi, bad thinking, nchogo, natsikis, has been replaced by good thinking, njogo, natsikis, and at least for a while the exigencies of life can be met with replenished equanimity. Those place names are strong. The foregoing account of aspects of Western Apache place name ideology supplies the basic conceptual framework with which to interpret the conversational encounter at the Machusa's home in Cibicu, but because the account has been formulated as Apache people themselves insist upon doing, that is, in abstract normative terms, it fails to elucidate what the practice of speaking with names served to accomplish on that particular occasion. In other words, we have yet to identify the social actions that participants in the encounter used their utterances to perform, and thus necessarily we have yet to grasp the coherence of their talk. So let us be about it. Having fashioned an account of the cultural logic on which speaking with names is understood to operate, attention may now be directed to an interpretation of how and with what sorts of interpersonal consequences this conversational practice was actually put to work. Once again, Lola Machus. That woman's younger brother acted stupidly. He was stupid and careless. He failed to show respect. No good. We said nothing critical about him to her. We talked around it. The social gathering at Lola Machusa's Ramada was uncomfortable for everyone, but especially for Louise. Troubled by her brother's sudden illness, she was troubled even more by his apparent lack of common sense. Having come into contact with the snakeskin near the Roundup camp, he should have gone directly to a ritual specialist for assistance in dealing with his contaminated state. That he failed to do so was disturbing enough, but that he treated the incident in such cavalier fashion was more disturbing still. Plainly, he was guilty of a grave lapse in judgment, and now, as surely he could have anticipated, he was suffering the painful consequences. Why had the young man acted so irresponsibly? In addition to being upset, Louise was sorely perplexed. Louise's chronicle of her brother's misfortune created an opportunity for all on hand to comment on his conduct. But because her account portrayed him in a distinctly unfavorable light, it also presented him as a target for easy criticism. If criticism were to be forthcoming, it could only serve to embarrass Louise, for she would have no alternative but to try to defend her brother's actions, and this would be awkward and difficult at best. Yet refusing to defend him could be taken to mean that she was prepared to condemn him entirely, and condemning one's relatives, especially in the presence of non-relatives, is a conspicuous violation of kinship loyalties that Western Apaches rarely see fit to excuse. For these reasons, Louise's candid statement places her companions in a delicate dilemma. On the one hand, no one could assert that Louise's brother had not acted wrongly without casting serious doubt on his or her own good judgment. On the other hand, no one could openly censure the young man without adding to Louise's discomfort, thereby displaying a lack of consideration for her feelings and a lack of concern for the circumstances that had produced them. How then to respond? How to speak the truth, or something that could be heard as not denying the truth, without exacerbating an already sensitive situation? Those place names really helped us out. We gave her pictures with place names. That way, she started feeling better. Those place names are strong. After finishing her account, Louise paused, took a long drink of Pepsi-Cola, and started to speak again of her beleaguered brother. But Lola Machuse intervened at this point, saying softly but firmly, "Se hadigaye yu agodza." It happened at Line of White Rocks extends up and out, at this very place. Lola's utterance was intended to evoke a historical tale for Louise to picture in her mind, but it was also designed to change the topic of talk and set the conversation on a new and different course. Instead of Louise's brother, whom Lola was showing she had no desire to criticize, attention was shifted to Louise herself and her troubled reactions to her brother's predicament. Instead of disapproval, Lola Machuse was exhibiting sympathy and concern. As later told by herself, the historical tale that Lola Machuse wished to evoke for Louise was the following. It happened at Line of White Rocks extends up and out. Long ago, a girl lived alone with her maternal grandmother. Her grandmother sent her out regularly to collect firewood. She went to a place above her camp. She could get there quickly by climbing up through a rocky canyon. Many snakes lived there, so her grandmother told her always to go another way. Then the girl went to collect firewood. The day was hot. Then the girl became thirsty. Then she thought, "This wood is heavy. I don't want to carry it too far." Then she started to walk down the rocky canyon. There were loose rocks where she walked. Then she slipped and fell down. The firewood she was carrying scattered everywhere. Then she started to pick it up. A snake bit her hand. Then she got scared. "My grandmother knew this would happen to me," she thought. Then the girl returned to where she was living with her grandmother. Her arm and hand became badly swollen. Then they worked over her, performing a curing ceremony. Later, the girl went to her grandmother. "My life is still my own," she said. Then her grandmother talked to her again. Now she knew how to live right. It happened. That line of white rocks extends up and out. As Lola Machuse had reason to suspect, Louise knew this story well. She had heard it many times and on several occasions, had performed it for her own children. Consequently, Louise reported later, her mind traveled instantly to a spot from which to view line of white rocks extends up and out, and images of the girl who was bitten by the snake appeared just as quickly. As a lengthy silence descended on the Machuse camp at Cibicue, Louise's thoughts moved along these lines. "A bad thing happened at that place, very bad. I saw that girl. She was impulsive. She forgot to be careful. She ceased showing respect. She was like my younger brother. She ceased thinking properly, so something bad happened to her. She became very scared, but recovered from it. She almost died, but held on to her own life." Lola Machuse's evocative comment had a calming effect on everyone sitting beneath the Ramada at her home. Her statement relieved Louise of any need to publicly defend her brother's conduct and, at the same time, charted a conversational path that others could easily follow. Acknowledging the felicity of the path and taking steps to pursue it, Emily produced a similar statement of her own. "Ha'a, tuji, yahigaiye yu agodza." Yes, it happened at whiteness spreads out descending to water, at this very place. And once again, Louise was urged to travel in her mind and picture a historical tale. Emily's version of this tale, which she said has been slightly abridged, is as follows. "It happened at whiteness spreads out descending to water. Long ago, a boy went to hunt deer. He rode on horseback. Pretty soon he saw one, a deer, standing on the side of a canyon. Then he went closer and shot it. He killed it. Then the deer rolled all the way down to the bottom of the canyon. Then the boy went down there. It was a buck, fat and muscular. Then he butchered it. The meat was heavy, so he had to carry it up in pieces. He had a hard time reaching the top of the canyon with each piece. Now it was getting dark. One hindquarter was still lying at the bottom of the canyon. I have enough meat already, he thought. So he left the hindquarter where it was lying. He left it there. Then he packed his horse and started to ride home. Then the boy got dizzy and nearly fell off his horse. Then his nose twitched uncontrollably, like deer's nose does. Then pain shot up behind his eyes. Then he became scared. Now he went back to the canyon. It was dark when he got there. He walked down to where the hindquarter was lying, but it was gone. Then he returned to his horse. He rode fast to where he was living with his relatives. The boy was sick for a long time. The people prayed for him on four separate occasions. He got better, slowly. No deer would present themselves to him. He said to his children, "Look at me now. I failed to be careful when I was a boy, and now I have a hard time getting meat for you to eat." It happened at whiteness spreads out, descending to water. The actions performed by Emily's utterance were readily apparent to Louise. Emily, like Lola Machuse before her, was attempting to distract Louise with constructive thoughts and comfort her with expressions of support. But Louise was not intimately familiar with the story of the boy and the deer, and though her mind went swiftly to a point near whiteness spreads out descending to water, she had difficulty picturing all the events in the story. She did, however, have one vivid image of the pain-ridden boy struggling to stay astride his horse, and this was sufficient to remind her of her brother. In addition, Louise said later, she could hear the boy, now an adult, as he spoke to his children about his fateful mistake. "It was like I could hear some old man talking. He was talking to his children. I was impatient, so I left behind good meat from that deer. Then I became very sick and very scared. I failed to show respect. Even so, that boy lived on and grew up and had children. He had learned to think right. So he talked to his children about it. Maybe my brother will learn to improve his thinking like that. The historical tale evoked by Emily is similar in several respects to the tale evoked by Lola Machuse, and at this point in the proceedings, Louise probably sensed that a pattern was starting to form. In both stories, young people are depicted as irresponsible and disrespectful, but for reasons having solely to do with their innocence and naivete, in both stories, they suffer life-threatening consequences, serious illness, and intense fright, from which they learn to avoid carelessness and impatience in the future. Finally, and most important of all, they regain their health and continue living, presumably for many years. Thus, the unstated message for Louise, which is also a prominent aspect of Western Apache ancestral knowledge, was a positive one. In effect, take heart. These things happen. Young people make foolish and dangerous mistakes, but they usually profit from them, and the mistakes are seldom fatal. Be optimistic. There is reason to believe your brother will recover. After a while, I gave her a funny story. She didn't get mad. She was feeling better. She laughed. Then she had enough, I guess. She spoke to the dog about her younger brother, criticizing him. So we knew we had helped her out. Following another lengthy silence inside the brush ramada, Lola Machuse acted to affirm and consolidate the tacit messages communicated thus far with a place name intended to evoke a third historical tale with similarities to the previous two, but with this utterance, Da'ani, ka'is dischi, na datine yu agodza. Truly. It happened at trail extends across a red ridge with alder trees, at this very place. She took a moderate risk. Although it deals with serious matters, the story Lola was thinking of presents a humorous aspect, and one of her purposes in evoking it was to lighten Louise's spirits and everyone else's by striking a note of reserved good cheer. The risk Lola ran was that her action would be perceived as intemperate, perhaps even playful, and thus inappropriate to the seriousness and solemnity of Louise's troubled circumstances. This is the historical tale as narrated by herself that Lola Machuse had in mind. It happened at trail extends across a red ridge with alder trees. A boy and a girl were newly married. He didn't know that he should stay away from her when her grandmother came to visit, when she was having her menstrual period. Then he tried to bother her. "Don't. I'm no good for that," she said. He was impatient. Then he tried to bother her again. Then she gave in. Then the boy got sick, they say. It was hard for him to sit down. Then his penis became badly swollen. Pissing was painful for him, too. He walked around, clutching his crotch. He was deeply embarrassed in front of his wife and her relatives. Then he got scared. "I wonder if I will be this way forever," he thought. Then someone talked to him, saying, "Don't bother your wife when her grandmother comes to visit. Stay away from her." Then that person gave the boy some medicine, saying, "Drink this. It will make you well. Then you can stop being embarrassed. Then you can stop walking around clutching your crotch. That is all." It happened at trail extends across a red ridge with alder trees. Fortunately, Lola Machuse's lighthearted gamble did not misfire. Louise traveled in her mind to a vantage point from which to picture trail extends across a red ridge with alder trees, viewed the crestfallen lad with his hand where it should never be seen in public, and returned from the journey mildly amused. Afterwards, Louise made these comments. "Everyone knows that story. My mind went there. It's funny to see that boy in the story holding on to himself. He should have left his wife alone. He was impulsive. He didn't think right. Then he got scared. Then he was made well again with medicine. I've heard that story often, but it's always funny to see that boy holding on to himself, so shy and embarrassed. At the Machusis home in Sibiku, Louise expressed her amusement by laughing softly. This was an auspicious sign. Though surely worried still, Louise had been moved to levity, and everyone could tell that her spirits had briefly improved. Here was evidence that the unspoken messages conveyed by Lola Machus and Emily, messages of sympathy, consolation, and encouragement, had been usefully received. Here was an indication that ancestral knowledge was providing Louise with a measure of comfort and hope. Seizing the moment, Robert Machus acted to make elements of these messages explicit, compressing their dominant thrust into one succinct statement. Kojo toliu. Pleasantness and goodness will be forthcoming, said Robert with quiet conviction. And moments later, endorsing his sentiments and adding conviction of their own, Lola Machus repeated the same phrase, Gojo toliu. Touched by this display of friendly goodwill, and aware that some sort of acknowledgement of it was now in order, Louise responded by taking a deft and self-effacing step. In the form of a mock question addressed to Clifford, the Machus's dog, she gently criticized her own brother. Shidige, binia shid ne goshe? My younger brother is foolish, isn't he, dog? The utterance accomplished several actions at once. First, by drawing attention away from herself, Louise gave notice that further evocations of traditional narratives could be politely dispensed with. In effect, you have all done enough. Also, by directing her question to one who could not answer it, Louise indicated that additional discussion of her brother and his difficulties would serve no useful purpose. In effect, let the matter rest. There is nothing more to say. Finally, and most adroitly of all, by voicing the thought that had been on everyone's mind from the beginning, that Louise's brother had indeed acted foolishly, she contrived to thank them for their tact in not having voiced it. In effect, this is the discrediting truth about my relative. I know it, and I know that you know it. You were polite and thoughtful to refrain from expressing it. As could have been predicted, Clifford did not respond to Louise's bogus query. Neither did anyone else. The speech event was over. A few minutes later, Louise and Emily rose to their feet, complained to each other about a sudden plentitude of flies, and set off together in search of a cold can of Pepsi-Cola. Lola Machus resumed her sewing, and Robert Machus went to water his horse. The day was beginning to cool, and the landscape beyond Sibiku, its rugged contours softened now by patches of lengthening shadow, looked more hospitable than before. Language, landscape, and the moral imagination. The possibilities of human language are variously conceived and variously understood. Every culture, whether literate or not, includes beliefs about how language works and what it is capable of doing. Similarly, every culture contains beliefs about the kinds of social contexts in which these capabilities may be realized most effectively. That such beliefs are present in contemporary Western Apache culture should now be obvious, and that they may operate in telling ways to influence patterns of verbal interaction should likewise be apparent. Moreover, it should now be possible to appreciate how aspects of Western Apache linguistic ideology contribute to perceptions of coherence in one form of Apache discourse, and also why, when contextual conditions are right, the same ideology may invest the briefest of utterances with ample meaning and substantial expressive force. The episode at Lola Machus's home suggests that while coherence in Western Apache discourse can be usefully described as a product of interlocking utterances and actions, the expressive force of Apache discourse, what people from Sibiku call its strength, nalwod, may be viewed as a product of multiple interlockings at different levels of abstraction. Put more exactly, it is my impression that those utterances that perform the broadest range of mutually compatible actions at once are those that Apaches experience as having the greatest communicative impact. In other words, the expressive force of an Apache utterance seems to be roughly proportionate to the number of separate but complementary functions it accomplishes simultaneously, or, as Alton Becker has intimated, to the number of distinguishable subject matters it successfully communicates about. The Western Apache practice of speaking with names manifests just this sort of range and versatility. Thus, as we have seen, an utterance such as Se hadigaye yu agodza, it happened at line of white rocks, extends up and out at this very place, may be used to accomplish all of the following actions. 1. Produce a mental image of a particular geographical location. 2. Evoke prior texts, such as historical tales and sagas. 3. Affirm the value and validity of traditional moral precepts, for example, ancestral knowledge. 4. Display tactful and courteous attention to aspects of both positive and negative face. 5. Convey sentiments of charitable concern and personal support. 6. Offer practical advice for dealing with disturbing personal circumstances, for example, apply ancestral knowledge. 7. Transform distressing thoughts caused by excessive worry into more agreeable ones marked by optimism and hopefulness. And 8. Heal wounded spirits. This is a substantial amount for any spoken utterance to be able to accomplish. And what provides for the capacity? What the forceful activity of speaking with names always communicates most basically about is the cultural importance of named locations within the Western Apache landscape. Named places have long been symbols of rich significance for the Apache people, and place names afford Apache speakers a ready means for appropriating that significance and turning it with brisk efficiency to specialized social ends. By virtue of their role as spatial anchors in traditional Apache narratives, place names can be made to represent the narratives themselves, summarizing them, as it were, and condensing into compact form their essential moral truths. As a result, narratives and truths alike can be swiftly activated and brought into focused awareness through the use of place names alone. And so it happens, on these occasions when Apache people see fit to speak with place names, that a vital part of their tribal heritage seems to speak to them as well. For on such occasions, as we have seen, participants may be moved and instructed by voices other than their own. In addition, persons to whom place names are addressed may be affected by the voices of their ancestors, voices that communicate in compelling silence with an inherent weight described by Mikhail Bakhtin as the authoritative word. The authoritative word demands that we acknowledge it, that we make it our own. It binds us, quite independent of any power it might have to persuade us internally. We encounter it with its authority already fused on it. The authoritative word is located in a distanced zone, organically connected with a past that is felt to be hierarchically higher. Its authority was already acknowledged in the past. It is a prior discourse. It is given, it sounds, in lofty spheres, not those of familiar contact. Its language is a special, as it were, hieratic language. When Western Apache place names are called upon to serve as vehicles of ancestral authority, the knowledge thus imparted is not so loftily given as to inhibit its use in the mundane spheres of everyday life. On the contrary, as the episode at the Machusa's home illustrates clearly, such knowledge exists to be applied, to be thought about and acted upon, to be incorporated. The more so, the better, Lola Machuse would have us understand, into the smallest corners of personal and social experience, and insofar as this kind of incorporation occurs, insofar as places and place names provide Apache people with symbolic reference points for the moral imagination and its practical bearing on the actualities of their lives, the landscape in which the people dwell can be said to dwell in them. For the constructions Apaches impose upon their landscape have been fashioned from the same cultural materials as constructions they impose upon themselves as members of society. Both give expression to the same set of values, standards, and ideals. Both are manifestations of the same distinctive charter for being in the world. Inhabitants of their landscape, the Western Apache are thus inhabited by it as well. And in the timeless depth of that abiding reciprocity, the people and their landscape are virtually as one. This reciprocal relationship, a relationship in which individuals invest themselves in the landscape while incorporating its meanings into their own most fundamental experience, is the ultimate source of the rich, sententious potential and functional versatility of Western Apache place names. For when place names are used in the manner exemplified by Lola Michus and her friends, the landscape is appropriated in pointedly social terms, and the authoritative word of Apache tribal tradition is brought squarely to bear on matters of social concern. Concomitantly, persons in distress are reminded of what they already know but may sometimes forget. That ancestral knowledge is a powerful ally in times of adversity, and that reflecting upon it, as generations of Apaches have learned, can produce expanded awareness, feelings of relief, and a fortified ability to cope. And because helping people to cope is regarded by Apaches as a gesture of compassion, the use of place names for this purpose serves as well to communicate solicitude, reassurance, and personal solidarity. The primary reason that speaking with names can accomplish so much, the reason its expressive force is sometimes felt so strongly, is that it facilitates reverberating acts of kindness and caring. And the effects of kindness and caring, especially when spirits are in need of healing, can be very strong indeed. As must now be apparent, the ethnographic account presented in this chapter has been shaped by a view of spoken communication which rests on the premise that languages consist in shared economies of grammatical resources with which language users act to get things done. The resources of a language, together with the varieties of action facilitated by their use, acquire meaning and force from the socio-cultural context in which they are embedded, and therefore, as every linguist knows, the discourse of any speech community exhibits a fundamental character, a genius, a spirit, an underlying personality that is very much its own. Over a period of years, I have become convinced that one of the distinctive characteristics of Western Apache discourse is a predilection for performing a maximum of socially relevant actions with a minimum of linguistic means. Accordingly, I have been drawn to investigate instances of talk, like the one involving Lola and Robert Michus, in which a few spoken words are made to accomplish large amounts of communicative work. For it is on just such occasions, I believe, that elements of Apache culture and society fuse most completely with elements of grammar and the situated aims of individuals, such that very short utterances, like polished crystals refracting light, can be seen to contain them all. On these occasions, the Western Apache language is exploited to something near its full expressive potential, and even Apaches themselves, struck momentarily by the power of their discourse, may come away impressed. Such powerful moments may not be commonplace in Western Apache speech communities, but they are certainly common enough. And when they occur, as on that hot and dusty day at Cibecue, robust worlds of meaning come vibrantly alive, conveying these worlds, capturing with words both the richness of their content and the fullness of their spirit, requires an exacting effort at linguistic and cultural translation that can never be wholly successful. The problem, of course, is that verbally mediated realities are so densely textured and incorrigibly dynamic, and that one's own locutions for representing them fail.